Across the Pacifica Network and over 60 community stations nationwide, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 10, 2003. I'm Kutza Mester. Deepa Fernandez is on assignment. Jordanians react to the Israeli airstrike against Syria. It is 1 year since the beginning of the zero-tolerance policies in Mexico City, implemented after hiring former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani as a consultant. It is also 1 year this weekend since the tragic Bali bombings, which killed 202 people. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The first woman judge in Iran is now the first Iranian and first Muslim woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Shirin Ebadi, according to the Nobel Committee, earned the award for her efforts for democracy and human rights, particularly for women and children in her country. In a press conference, she said, "The fight for human rights is conducted in Iran by the Iranian people, and we are against any foreign intervention in Iran." The Red Cross is breaking silence on their observations at Guantanamo Bay about the treatment of prisoners being held there. Craig Murphy reports from D.C.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says that the foreign prisoners being held indefinitely by the U.S. military on their base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has had a significantly negative impact on the detainees' mental health. The ICRC is the only non-government-affiliated organization to have regular access to the prisoners because they promised to keep quiet about the physical conditions of the so-called Camp X-Ray and the 660 people held there. However, the ICRC has stated that they are making these criticisms public because of the U.S. government's lack of action. In an interview from the ICRC, Beatrice Megavan Rogo, the ICRC Delegate General for Europe and the Americas, described their criticisms of the Guantanamo Bay detentions.
The detention system in Guantanamo is an open-ended one in which the detainees do not know at all what is going to happen to them, how long they're going to be held there, and what will be the outcome of this.
Yesterday, a group of former military officials, federal judges, and diplomats, along with human rights advocates, filed 7 Friend of the Court briefs urging the Supreme Court to review the cases of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The group challenged the legality of holding the people indefinitely based upon the Geneva Conventions, international law, and the U.S. Constitution. For Free Speech Radio News, in Washington, D.C., I'm Craig Murphy.
A Canadian-born Israeli soldier began his 28-day military prison term for refusing to serve in the occupied West Bank. The 33-year-old paratrooper said, "I believe with all my heart that in refusing to serve in the occupied territories, I am serving the State of Israel in the most important manner." And overnight, the Israeli military invaded the Rafah refugee camp, killing 7 people. Mohammed Galiini has more from Gaza City.
The Israeli occupation army invaded the Rafah refugee camp Thursday night in an operation that they said could go on for 1 week. According to Israeli officials, the army is searching for tunnels which could be used to smuggle advanced weapons such as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles from Egypt. If true, this would give the Palestinian resistance some form of protection from the superiorly equipped Israeli army. As of this morning, following house-to-house searches, the army found no tunnels. In the past 3 years, more than 200 homes have been demolished in Rafah in search of these tunnels, leaving more than 5,000 people homeless. According to Dr. Ali Musa of Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, 7 people were killed by the invading Israeli army, 2 children amongst them. Rafah and the entire Gaza Strip has been under Israeli military blockade since Sunday. This led to the death today of a newborn baby in Rafah who needed oxygen treatment in an incubator at the Gaza European Hospital just 2 miles outside Rafah. For FSRN in Gaza, I'm Mohammed Galayini.
A U.S. congressional delegation will travel to the Tex-Mex border to investigate the hundreds of disappearances, rapes, and gruesome murders of young women. Shannon Young reports from KPFT in Houston.
Two Texas congressmen, Ciro Rodriguez and Silvestre Arregues, will travel to El Paso and Ciudad Juarez with Representatives Hilda Solis of East L.A. and Luis Gutierrez of Chicago as part of a fact-finding mission. The congressional delegation will meet with relatives of the disappeared women as well as investigators on both sides of the border. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime concluded after last week's trip to Juarez that Mexican police must receive training in the proper techniques of handling forensic evidence. Many of the decomposed bodies encountered in the desert have yet to be identified. Families of the disappeared charged the local and state authorities with corruption and cite obstructionism as one of the major blocks to a serious investigation. The congressional delegation is expected to remain in Juarez through Monday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Young in Houston.
Protesters in Colorado were denied the chance to take their message to NATO defense ministers. Len Huell explains from KGNU in Boulder.
With NATO members meeting in Colorado Springs, six members of Citizens for Peace in Space were kept from expressing their message to the members. Spokesman Bill Saltzman explains the scene and why they were there.
There were, dozens of policemen standing by. They could have just as well been standing by two blocks up the road if they thought six of us were somehow a physical danger to the NATO delegates. So I think it was maybe just a trial balloon. I don't know whether this is going to be the norm now when they have any kind of controversial convention. But if so, we're in trouble.
The American Civil Liberties Union is looking into whether the group's First Amendment rights have been violated. For Free Speech Radio News in Boulder, Colorado, this is Len Huell.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As Thursday marked the six-month anniversary of U.S. and British forces toppling the statue of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, today the death toll rises as two more U.S. soldiers were killed and four others injured in a Baghdad neighborhood. This comes on a day when Vice President Dick Cheney defended the Bush administration's actions in Iraq, saying, quote, "Terrorists are doing everything they can to get weapons of mass destruction." Israel defended its attack earlier this week on Syria as a preemptive strike. This, coupled with a U.S. move to impose sanctions on the country, has sparked anger and condemnation around the Arab world, underlining fears that Syria might be the next country the United States targets. Ula Farawati has more in Iman Jordan.
This week's Israeli attack on Syria, the first Israeli attack deep inside the country since the 1973 war, followed by the U.S. move to impose sanctions on the country days later, has sent shivers across the Arab world. Many in the region here fear Syria will be the next for what people perceive as a U.S.-led anti-Arab, anti-terror campaign. Fahd al-Rimawi is the chief editor of the Jordanian weekly Al Majd, which supports Syrian initiatives.
What happened in Syria, whether in Innis Sahib or in the Congress, is all connected to the U.S. stance on Syria, which is an antagonistic stance not only against Syria, but against the whole Arab world.
The preliminary U.S. congressional approval of sanctions against Syria sparked an angry response from Damascus Thursday, with the Syrian official news agency Sana calling it, quote, "a biased and illogical act that would damage U.S.-Syria relations and dim chances for peace in the Middle East." President of Jordan's Bar Association, Hassan Mjalli, believes the vote by the U.S. House International Relations Committee was a largely symbolic gesture, but one that could lead to more damaging U.S. measures.
This is a continuous war between the Arab nation and its enemies throughout history, between occupiers and the Arab nation. This war would not finish but by the end of the occupation, and Syria is a part of all this.
Many here in the region say the U.S. move to impose sanctions on Syria, days after Israel authorized the airstrike outside of the Syrian capital of Damascus, as strong support for Israeli foreign policy in the Middle East. In light of this week's developments, Arab citizens are hard-pressed to separate U.S. President George Bush's words endorsing this week's Israeli attack as legitimate and, quote, preemptive. Many here are now growing to believe that any country the U.S. indicates as hostile to Israel would eventually be targeted. And Muhammad is a Syrian citizen residing in Jordan.
This is all for Israel. May God destroy America and its army. Israel wants to occupy the whole Arab world, and the U.S. is supporting it.
Analysts here openly worry the whole Middle East region would plunge further into a vicious circle of violence if any U.S.-led action against Syria intensifies. The same analysts add, however, that only a change of the Syrian stance against Israel towards a peace accord will spare it a military attack. Hussein Mjalli, the Bar Association's president, again.
The world plan is forcing the region, country by country, to enter this vicious cycle. First was Iraq, then Syria, then you never know, maybe Jordan or Egypt. This will not end but by collective Arab action.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News host Deepa Fernandez is in Austin, Texas today at a gathering of women activists from around the country to draw attention to the fast deteriorating economic and human rights situation of women under the Bush administration. She brings us this report.
President Bush has signed a six-month extension of the welfare reform law TANF, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, just ahead of its expiration. Under the current TANF program, otherwise known as welfare reform, a single mother with two children receives a payment of $356 a month. And for more than a year, Congress has been working on bills that would reauthorize the TANF program. Versions of the legislation making their way through the House and Senate would increase the required number of work-related hours for TANF recipients, but would not provide additional funding for childcare. The end results, experts say, would force parents to spend more time away from their children and bear the costs of additional childcare expenses.
Under welfare, previously, women were able to have the opportunity to fulfill their education and go and get a four-year degree, which would empower them to get a good-paying job and to spend more time with their children as a result.
Jacqueline Payne is a policy attorney for Now Legal Defense and Education Fund.
And Congress is, in all its wisdom, is looking at restricting that and forcing them out of education and into very low-paying jobs or even no-paying jobs just so they can get the little bit of assistance they need through TANF. The bill in Congress right now, unfortunately, is really punitive and restrictive and doesn't provide women with the support to make those choices and, in fact, is really stunting women's ability to reach those goals.
Payne is one of the many women gathered today in Austin, Texas, under the auspices of the Ms. Foundation for Women, to draw attention to the fast deteriorating economic and human rights of women under the Bush administration. Human rights, say these women, should be inextricably linked to economic rights, as Loretta Ross, executive director of the Center for Human Rights Education, explains using the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Social human rights. Social human rights can be found in Article 25. Now, I want to ask Bill Clinton and everybody who follows him in that neoliberal thinking, what part of this they didn't understand when they did welfare reform? Let us be clear. It says people have an entitlement, a right to these things. This is not optional. When you vote against feeding people, you are voting to violate their human rights.
Under a TANF reauthorization bill recently passed by the Senate Finance Committee, the work requirement would increase at least 2 hours a week for most families. A House version of the bill would increase the requirement to 40 hours a week. And this comes down hardest on women, as does the lack of basic human rights in fields such as domestic work and childcare, says Yvonne Thompson Friend of Philadelphia organization Child Space Cooperative Development.
When you deal with childcare workers who are living below the poverty levels most times, they're eligible for welfare benefits. They are women, 90% and higher, and they are women of color, 85% and higher, depending on where you are in the country, where they're actually having to work several jobs to care for our children and educate our children. This is a violation of human rights for them to work in the conditions that they work under with no consideration and very little societal support.
Policies that criminalize the homeless also affect women and children at rates not often noted by policymakers. And for women gathered in Austin, it's a time for naming and calling out grievances with the Bush administration and its track record of human rights abuses against women.
I am from that state where that scary guy comes from, in charge of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge.
Sherry Hunkeler, former homeless mother, is the founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union.
He quickly taught me about how to use a human rights framework when one cold evening, after living on the Capitol stairs with over 60 homeless families, he ordered the removal of the blankets of the homeless families at about 2 o'clock in the morning on the coldest night in October. That night we went to Sheets Grocery Store. Women and children wrapped themselves in plastic and in cardboard, and we walked throughout the evening so that nobody died from hypothermia. It was that night that grown men and women talked about and used the language of human rights.
From micro-enterprise practitioners to workplace organizers, the women gathered in Austin represent a cross-section of the grassroots campaigns united to bring basic human rights into workforces and programs desperately needed for women. But participants in the meeting say that educating women and people of color to lobby against upper-income elected officials will continue to be an obstacle. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
It is 1 year since the beginning of the zero-tolerance policies in Mexico City, implemented by Mexico City's government after hiring as a consultant former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Although the set of recommendations by Giuliani has been well-received by business groups, civil rights activists have indicated that there have been a marked increase of human rights violations. Vladimir Flores and Carlo Martinez have more from Mexico City.
Residents of Mexico live in a constant fear of kidnappings, rape, murders, and decades of drug wars. 80% of the crimes committed go unreported due to the high level of corruption from the government to the police. It comes former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Giuliani partners receive a contract from a group private business owner led by Carlos Slim. Giuliani's 146 recommendations were held by Mexico City Police and Chief Mayor, but many say it is not enough. Laura is a university student and she lives in downtown Mexico.
The image is what is taken care of. They spend money in image and in police. You see that there are many police, but the situation do not change. In some way, police serves only to contain the anger and desperation of people, but really do not help. You even see the corruption in police.
Giuliani enter office attacking panhandlings, clubs, homelessness, and minority communities, declaring a war on crime in New York City. Young men of color were routinely being searched and harassed on the streets. Prisons began to overcrowd with no violent drugs offenders, and public services and education budgets got cut for increased police funding. For indigenous groups and young people in Mexico City, a zero-tolerance policy represents real dangers. Specialist in hemispheric security of the Metropolitan Autonomous University, José Luis Piñeiro, emphasized that the zero-tolerance is a strategy of control and social containment.
We can call it public security doctrine that basically proposes that it doesn't concern the type of crime that is committed, but that this must punish. Is that is a greater crime or not? There are programs of social containment because it doesn't make a difference between the organized crime, the professional crime, and the occasional or circumstantial crime.
The price tag for Giuliani's 146 recommendations was $4.3 million, but the price citizens will endure under such tight security. Secretary of Public Security Marcelo Ebrard, in August 8th, announced the beginning of new rules to fight smaller crimes, like alcohol drinking in the streets or graffiti. Mario is 15 years old and is a graffiti writer in Mexico City.
This is a real battle. It is a fight, but not exactly against the police. It's necessary to have a certain way to operate for not to fall, knowing the traps that they are putting to us, and so much more with the laws that they are doing, because now there's already jail way to us.
Implementing Giuliani's policies would increase the borrowing currency affecting the Mexican economy. The peso weakened this week, dropping 4.9% due to the investor cutting back over the concern for Mexico's slow growth. Currently, on 2.4% of the population has access to the opportunities. José Luis Piñeiro from the Autonomous Metropolitan University talked about the absence of this type of consideration in the combat to delinquency.
It's necessary to say that when trying to apply and to use the Giuliani strategy for a city as source, this ignores the enormous economic and social inequalities that there are in great sectors of the population.
A zero-tolerance policy, it may bring crime down in Mexico City, but many citizens doubt the effectiveness of the zero-tolerance policy as long as civil servant corruption remains. The real victims of such policies will be the citizens of Mexico City. For Free Speech Radio News, we are Vladimir Flores and Ricardo Martinez in Mexico City.
The Casamance is the southern part of Senegal, and since 1982, Casamance has seen intense fighting between the Senegalese military and fighters, known as the Movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance, or MFDC, which has greatly endangered the region. Landmines and proliferation of light weapons have made it impossible for civilians to work on their rice farms and orchards. This past May, the president of the rebel group met with the Senegalese president, and they signed a 10-point declaration for peace in the Casamance. One of the points mandated a meeting with all of the different factions of the MFDC this week. On the final day of talks, Ndiaga Seck brings us this report from Senegal.
J'avais déclaré en septembre et octobre 2002.
In September and October 2002, I declared solemnly that for us, the war was in the past. I wanted to reaffirm it strongly here and now. For us, the war is bygone for good.
La guerre pour nous est définitivement révolue.
The MFDC, Movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance, is comprised of many states. Meetings were held this week to reach a unified voice before meeting with the Senegalese government. Many MFDC members living in exile have come from France, Switzerland, Gambia, and Guinea-Bissau to strategize with the interior wing of the movement. Initially scheduled for Guinea-Bissau, the MFDC meeting opened in Ziguinchor on Monday due to the coup in Bissau. Opening the meeting, Jean-Marie Bernard Biagi, Secretary General of the movement, in front of a southern people, declared MFDC will no longer resort to armed conflict. But he also says how they see the future of Casamance. I've said socio-economic, political and cultural emancipation of Casamance, but I could have talked about autonomy of Casamance, or even socio-economic, political and cultural independence of Casamance. These three notions lead to one and only finality, the capacity Casamance would have to decide by herself for any interdependence to local or foreign entities. The Casamance conflict has triggered an economic crisis. Today, poverty rate has reached 37%, yet the region was the granary of Senegal. Proliferation of light weapons in the region has multiplied rackets and armed burglary. The most vulnerable in the conflict, women, have been victims of landmines and armed attacks. At the meetings this week, women were included in the panel to voice their opinions. Margot Kolikini, spokeswoman of the association Let Bygone Be Bygone, or Kabanketor, says women can no longer stand losing sons and husbands in this war. Our wish, us women, main victims of this unfortunate situation, is to see all the sons of this region, I mean sons of Senegal, sit around the same table to discuss strategies in order to reach a perfect reconciliation of hearts and minds for a just, durable and definitive peace. Civilian populations in Casamance have seen many other meetings, but the outcome has yet to change their daily lives. Now the people in Ziguinchor seem to be optimistic due to the number of representatives attending the meetings. Except Alexandre Djiba and this is the warlord Sidi Badji's partisans, who still root for independence. Many NGO representatives prefer to keep a low profile, expressing neutrality as they facilitated the meetings in hopes of reaching peace. The private sector also attended the meetings. The MFDC sees the companies interested in reconstruction of Casamance as potential partners and investors. Ousmane Sindiaye, Executive Secretary of INACWA, National Union of Senegalese Businessmen, says they respect the spirit of the movement to get the best results out of this meeting.
Nous allons intervenir doublement. Nous avons la chance.
We'll intervene in both sides. We have the chance and opportunity to have at the same time the government and MFDC as partners. I would just add that we are the private sector and we represent more than 60% of the gross national product. So we are engaged in partnership with the government in order to help in economic and social development in general.
Pour aider au développement économique et social de manière générale.
The MFDC meeting reached a resolution of a unified voice in the coming negotiation with Senegalese government and assistance with the reconstruction. Senegalese government will start mine clearance and many of the injured MFDC fighters will be cured in hospitals in Senegal's capital, Dakar. The venue and date of negotiations are yet to define. In Senegal, this is Ndiaga Seck for Free Speech Radio News.
This Sunday marks the first anniversary of the bombings in Bali, Indonesia that killed 202 people, including 7 Americans, 88 Australians, and 38 Balinese. Not only did the Bali bombings bring terrorism to Australia's doorstep, but it has ushered in an era where Australia is asserting itself in the Asia-Pacific region to fight terrorism, a move that is straining relations with its neighbors, including Indonesia. 1 year on from Bali, Guy Deegan reports from Sydney, Australia.
Since the Bali bombings, the doctrine of Australia's Prime Minister John Howard is to ensure that any close neighbour, especially small Pacific Island countries, do not become so-called failed states and open to exploitation by terrorists.
We know that a failed state in our region, on our doorstep, will jeopardise our own security. The best thing we can do is to take remedial action and to take it now.
It's a statement that makes it clear that Australia is prepared to use its armed forces to get its way. But it's a statement unsupported by evidence that tiny Pacific Islands are bases for terrorists. Following a deployment of 2,000 troops and police to the Solomon Islands, Australia has now pressured aid-dependent Papua New Guinea into accepting 200 Australian police to revamp its national police force. But how welcome is this type of active intervention? Speaking on Australia's special broadcasting service, PNG's Prime Minister Sir Michael Somare rejects the idea that Papua New Guinea is a failing state.
Papua New Guinea has not gone to the verge of breaking down. Australia has got their own agenda. Australia wants to have its influence in the region. We know that. All the Pacific Islanders knew that. Australia wants to exert its authority like the Americans have exerted their authority in the world. Australia wants to exert its authority in the Pacific. We understand.
Australia might be able to exert its authority with small nations dependent on its aid funding, but that's never been the case with Indonesia, even after Bali.
There was hope for a significant improvement in the relationship between the two countries. However, since that time, I think the level of cooperation between Indonesia and Australia, but also Indonesia and the United States, has collapsed.
Scott Birchall from the School of Social and International Studies at Deakin University. The Bali bombings and subsequent trials of suspected Jemaah Islamiyah terrorists has further complicated a relationship already strained after Australia's intervention in East Timor gaining independence in 1999. But justice for the Bali bombings is an Australian priority and requires mutual cooperation with Indonesia. International observers argue that this has now seen Australia turn a blind eye to the military atrocities occurring in West Papua and Aceh. Ed Aspinall from the University of Sydney says nothing reveals this stance more clearly than Australia's recommencement of joint military training with the disgraced Indonesian Special Forces, CAPASSIS.
Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer was criticised on this grounds. He said that, you know, safeguarding the interests or the well-being of Australian citizens who might in some future scenario be victims of a terrorist attack in Australia would always take precedence over what he called some esoteric concern with human rights in Indonesia. So that's clearly an indication of the way that the Australian government views the human rights of Indonesian citizens.
So 1 year on from Bali, how do Indonesia and Australia view each other? Ed Aspinall.
It's such a complex relationship. The Indonesian government itself is a very broad and represents a very broad and even ramshackle coalition of interests, and there are elements within the Indonesian government who are not particularly interested, to be honest, with Australia's point of view. In general terms, there's a very great degree of mutual incomprehension and misunderstanding on both sides.
Sunday's anniversary in Bali will end a tumultuous week in the relationship between Indonesia and Australia. Plans to invite Prime Minister Howard to address a business forum at the ASEAN summit this week in Bali were blocked by Indonesian officials. And President Megawati Sukarnoputri will now not attend the commemoration service out of respect for Balinese Hindu customs. In Sydney, Australia, I'm Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Pacifica Radio's Free Speech Radio News. I'm Kata Master.